or they won't appear at all. Either way, it's good. I have another question. So I'm Steve Marks, by the way, and I work on the Windows Azure team. And I have another question. How many people follow me on Twitter already? My Twitter name is Smarks. So you guys have seen, so a few of you have seen my demo already. I'm so glad that it wasn't the entire room, because I was sort of worried that I let the cat out of the bag last night by tweeting my demo. So the rest of you are going to get to enjoy for the first time some of the fun of that demo. This is a Silverlight demo of numbers incrementing. Thank you. All right, let's see if does the clicker work? Oh, the clicker works. That's so fantastic. Okay, so this is, I don't know what we called the thing here, but it was a platform overview for developers, I think, or something. Here, since I stole slides, some of the slides that I used at Mix, I'm using the title Lap Around the Windows Azure Platform. But really, the idea of this session is to kind of ground you guys all in what the full Windows Azure platform is. So Windows Azure, SQL Azure, Dallas, App Fabric, the whole thing. So guys, get everybody sort of on the same page of what's in there, give a little bit of the rationale for it, and just get us going and on the same page. And then also a few demos that kind of put a few pieces together. So this is me. Yes, I drew that myself. It looks a lot like me, I think. My Twitter name is Smarks. My blog is at smarks.com. And so you guys can follow me there. I'm a technical strategist on the Windows Azure team, which is a title that I made up. And really what I do is I do a lot of this stuff. I do a lot of blogging and forum stuff and just a lot of kind of developer outreach things. And I try to think about, while I'm doing that, sort of where the platform has to go in the next maybe 12 to 18 months, and what are the emerging technologies, what are people using, what are people trying to do. So feel free to contact me about any thoughts that you have about Windows Azure. So the goals of this talk, first just sort of orientation, what are all the pieces, how do they fit together? More importantly, I think, is an understanding of the platform and why it is the way it is and how you should think about the platform. And because I wrote this thing, Cute Zoomy Tricks with the Silverlight, this is, by the way, this is an app of my own design at onebigslide.com, and you can't use it, but I get to. It's not quite stable enough, so I haven't given out the source code, but just so no one gets distracted, it's just a way of showing slides. So Windows Azure Platform, we're going to actually look at the right column first. We're just going to go through kind of what I think of as the core attributes of the platform. Scale, automation, and the developer experience. And then we're going to look at the various pieces of the Windows Azure platform and how it lets you host applications, how it helps you to store and manage data, and how it helps you to connect those applications together. So before we do that, let me talk about kind of the idea behind the Windows Azure platform, which is that we've moved since, you know, sort of the beginnings of modern computing from thinking about transistors and how do I lay out a system, and what connects to what and what sort of gates do I use and things like that, to thinking about chips. How do I write the machine code that's going to be executed by this chip? Eventually we thought of, hey, we could have assemblers that would help us do this. But we had all these devices. How do I connect to those? Oh, my code is different if I'm using a different kind of peripheral, et cetera. So we have a motherboard, and it has a bus, and now we get to program those things. We get an operating system, and that means we can think about only what's sort of above that whole level. Like, no one, depends what you do, but most of us who are writing applications today never think about, well, what's the chipset or which motherboard is in this box or what kind of disk is it, except to the extent it sort of affects performance or something. But we don't program to that layer. We program to the machine. And this is basically what operating systems give us. If you have Windows, then you get sort of automated memory management, all those things, and it's provided by the operating system. Now, a lot of us, probably everyone in this room, are building applications that run on a lot of different computers and run perhaps in many different data centers even. And yet, our support from the operating system is at the level of a server, and we're sort of stuck there. We've been stuck there for quite some time, I think, where yeah, there are sort of programming frameworks for building systems that span multiple computers, but you still worry about what's inside that. Like when you build an application that's running, you know, in a big data center, you think about servers and you think about the networking gear and you have to figure out what load balancer to get and whether the router's configured correctly and all that stuff, right? So we've never gotten an abstraction layer that's beyond kind of the server. Maybe a little of a bit of an exaggeration, but I don't think it's much of one. I think really we tend to think about servers still. The idea of the Windows Azure platform is to provide this abstraction, is to say, look, you're building applications that target data centers and a whole bunch of computers spread throughout the world with CDNs and networks and connectivity back to your data center and things like that. Windows Azure platform puts all that stuff in the box and lets you just worry about writing the application that lives on top of that. Okay, so that's the idea. That's in some sense an aspiration and a goal and a vision. And in some sense, we've taken some big steps towards that. So that's sort of the fundamental way to think about the Windows Azure platform, and particularly that idea with scale, right? So scale is the whole internet, really. Scale is data centers around the globe. It's elastic resources. The idea is that if you want to scale something out and then scale it back down in, you should be able to do that really easily. So this is sort of capturing the idea that your application doesn't have a sort of fixed set of resources, it changes. Utility billing I've kind of put in here with scale. You might think of it a different way, but I think it's really key to enabling sort of this scale is that you pay for only what you use. The meters are fairly simple. The number of hours your app was running, the bandwidth it consumed, the storage that you're using. And so without that, this goal of, well, I'm going to scale things out and scale back down doesn't really mean anything without the business model that fits there that says you only pay for what you're using when you're using it. So automation is the second big attribute, I think, of Windows Azure platform beyond scale, and that's that everything is automated. I mean, I'm talking about from booting up computers in the data center, you know, from our internal stuff. How do we turn on computers? How do we configure load balancers, et cetera? We automate all that. From your perspective, how do you deploy your application? Well, you press a button and then some things happen inside. And you have a lot of control over what those things are that happen. But it's done not by humans, but by machines, right? So the idea is that we use software to automate all these things. We automate things like recovering from a failure. A VM crashes, even just your app throws an exception. Well, we can restart you or move you to a different VM, whatever we need to do to kind of fix that all automatically. We do upgrades, automation, and everything is programmable. So once you've automated everything, then there's no reason why you have to call someone to ask something to happen. You can use our API and do it programmatically. So we'll, as we touch the individual pieces of the platform, we'll take a look at this in a little more detail, but automation is really fundamental to how we do things in the platform. Developer experience is, I think, one of the places where Microsoft is best suited to win, as it were, in the cloud. I think that, you know, building a solid developer platform and using familiar tools, using web standards, we've done some good integration with Visual Studio in a lot of places, but we've also done command line tools and plugins for other IDEs like Eclipse to give you language choice. So you get to choose whether you're doing .NET, which is, you know, my preferred platform, or you're doing PHP or Java or Ruby or Python or Eiffel or Erlang or Lisp, whatever you guys want. And that is really a goal of the platform, is that you can use all these things from all these different languages. We've built new programming models where it makes sense, and I will touch on that specifically when we talk about Windows Azure and hosting applications. So we've given programming models that help you to build better applications, but there's not a lot that you need to learn if you don't need it. So we've done a lot on trying to make it very familiar, but still, since we're trying to push that abstraction layer up, put in different abstractions and different programming models where they are going to help you to build better apps and more scalable apps and more reliable apps. Okay, so that was the brief kind of, that's all I'm going to say about the platform as a whole. For the rest of this, we're going to go zoom in on individual pieces, and then we're going to show some demos of the different pieces and talk about sort of technical stuff and get into developer story for some of these things. So I've broken up the platform into three pieces. These are sort of my logical way of thinking about it. They're not necessarily directly mapped to sort of components in the platform, but I'll show you what the components are in each one. So applications are the first thing that I want to talk about, and for that we have Windows Azure. So branding MetaPoint, we have a service called Windows Azure, which hosts your applications and your storage. We have a platform called the Windows Azure Platform, of which Windows Azure is one component. So all the stuff we're going to talk about here is under the umbrella of the Windows Azure Platform. Windows Azure is one specific element of that. So I know that can sometimes be confusing, so I just wanted to make that point. Windows Azure is scalable hosting of your application and of your data. It provides a simple developer experience, and it, like everything else, does automated management. But here, particularly, automated management about your app. So deploying your application, upgrading, scaling, and things like that. That's what Windows Azure does. The word Windows is in Windows Azure for a reason, because we think of it, it's not an operating system. Just to be clear, Windows Azure, we use an operating system metaphor sometimes, and I have here. It's not an operating system. Underneath, we run Windows on a bunch of servers in a data center, and there's some software that helps you to kind of manage it all together. But we branded it in this with the Windows word because we do think of this as a platform. We think about it as an open platform in the same way that Windows is, and that so I'm happy to look around and see all the laptops and see that most of them don't have an Apple logo on them, so you guys are probably running Windows. And that's, yes, I know, I'm looking at you with the Apple. But that's, okay, good. No, we've got at least one, thank you. I'm running Windows on the Mac, so I'm happy. But why am I happy? I have no idea what apps you guys are running on these machines. I just know that you're running Windows, and that is good for me because I'm a Microsoft employee, and Windows is one of our greatest products, and we want lots of people to be running on Windows. And then if you're running a Java app on there or you're running something, I mean, I don't care if it's a .NET app or if it's an Adobe Air. A lot of you are probably running TweetDeck right now, and it's on an Adobe product. I do care. I would like you to do something else, but Windows is really the important thing from my perspective there, right? That you guys are running that operating system. The same thing is true in Windows Azure. Like, you might choose to write an app in .NET or in PHP or in Java or Ruby. As long as you're running in my data center and you're running as far in the Windows Azure platform, I'm happy. So when we talk about interoperability of Windows Azure, think about it the same way as you think about it on Windows, that it's in our best interest to enable as many different platforms to work on our cloud as possible. And so our expertise, our primary sort of core competency might be around .NET and that platform, but I run Java code in the cloud. PHP is a really common one that a lot of folks run. We did a talk at the Mix conference recently about running Ruby on Rails on Windows Azure. It's really wide open. If you guys can think of something else that we haven't thought of. Oh, you can run Apache on Windows Azure. If you don't want to run IIS, you can run Apache or Tomcat or Jetty or a little web server called Mongoose that I've been playing with lately because it's a single file executable and it's about 40 kilobytes. So it's sort of the easiest demo to do of a web server. But think Windows in terms of the programming model of sort of how wide open it is. And if you want to sort of go one layer deeper on the programming model for Windows Azure or what you might be able to run on Windows Azure, the thing to think about, the mental model to have is imagine you've got an application to run. I have a server sitting under my desk. And I say, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to create a user for you. You're going to hand me a USB key with all your stuff on it. I'm going to stick it in. I'm going to go to the F drive or whatever it is, and I'm going to do runme.bat. And if you can run in that mode, then great. But if you go, no, I can't run that mode because I need Windows Server 2003 and you have Windows Server 2008, or I can't run in that mode because I have to install Office first or something like that, then you're going to have trouble on the Windows Azure platform. So basically, but anything that can be kind of copy deployed, just copy it onto a box and run it and it works, is going to be in good shape. So let's talk about scale again in Windows Azure. There's really two kinds of scale. There's scale up, which is, I've got a server And now I have too many users, so I buy a bigger server. And then I have too many users again, so I throw that one out, get an even bigger server. And that's scale up. That's just bigger and bigger hardware. This is what most people do to scale databases, because you want everything to still be on that box, and you just want to cram more stuff onto it. So you buy a huge, 64-core machine with a ton of RAM and stuff, and you just buy big, big iron. The other model, as opposed to scale up, is what we do, scale out in Windows Azure. And scale out is I have one server, now I have too many users, so I buy a second server. And when I have two more users, I buy five more servers, and I just sort of spread things out across the servers. So this is the model that we do in Windows Azure. There's a bit of scale up because you can kind of choose different virtual machine sizes, so you can kind of get bigger or smaller if you need to in that sense. But the primary way that you scale is by adding servers. That's how you add capacity. And the way you scale it back down is just the opposite. Just take them back down. Okay. So this has implications on the programming model. Because where you used to assume, if you're running on a single box, really it has the same implications that web farms do. I mean, it's the same. If you're going to put several things behind a load balancer, well, you have a different programming model now, because where you used to just remember the state of the application, like the shopping cart is the example. You had a server, user clicked some button, added something to the shopping cart, they click checkout, and you say, okay, here's your bill. If you have 10 servers, then they clicked add to cart on one of the servers, and when they clicked checkout, it went to a different server. So your shopping cart information better be somewhere centralized or, stored or shared across all those different machines. So this idea of scale out does change the programming model. It's not specific to Windows Azure or the Windows Azure platform. It's really pretty much any cloud offering is doing scale out. Everybody who's doing web farms with ASP.NET or things like that, where they just stand up a bunch of web servers behind a load balancer, already knows this and has already figured this out. So it's not brand new, but it's something to keep in mind when you think about the programming model. So I'm trying to think of how to do this. Let's do a demo, because that's more fun. Let me switch over to my laptop here, and let's just close this and start something new. Sure. What's that? Is that a Mac? No, it is not a Mac. I like this audience. So let's create a new project. So what we're going to do here is we're just going to create like the hello world of Windows Azure, okay? And then I'm going to go back and explain some of the concepts. But I think it's a little bit easier to just see it once first. So because I've installed the SDK, I have this new set of cloud templates in Visual Studio. So I'm going to create a Windows Azure cloud service. You can see I do this a lot because it's going to be called Cloud Service 21. Let's do Hello Firestarter instead. It's a little bit better. So we're going to create this project, and then it's going to ask me a question. And we're going to come back to this, but I just want you guys to sort of take a mental bookmark that one of the first things it did was sort of ask me what I wanted to do. I'm going to just add a little ASP.NET web role and call it Hello Firestarter Web. But there's more that I could do here, and we're going to talk about what that means. And Visual Studio is now going to create two things for me. And this is kind of the cool part about the familiarity of the experience, is that this node up here, Hello Firestarter, that's a cloud application. That's new. Okay? But this node, Hello Firestarter Web, is an ASP.NET application. It's not anything different. This is literally, if you open the project file and whatever, it's an ASP.NET application. Now, I've gotten some references for some runtime libraries and whatever in Windows Azure, but we're not actually going to use them in here. So this demo, we could literally just create a new ASP.NET application and then just go right-click, sort of add to solution. Right? So this part is exactly the same as what you've done if you're doing ASP.NET. Now, if you do some other programming language like PHP, it's, again, this part of it is just going to be your PHP stuff, and there's no cloud-specific stuff. So the idea is that you can move these things in and out without too much trouble. Okay, so in here we're going to say, hello, Firestarter. And we're going to type it again just to see if I can spell it both times. And for fun, let's do something else. let's say instance count equals 2. Because there's got to be some part, if I just run this without changing that to 2, then it's pretty much just like running an ASP.NET app. Here I'm going to change it to 2, which means we've got 2 instances of this, or 2 copies of this running. So we're already going to have a load balancer with a couple different things running behind it. And now I've pressed F5, just run in Visual Studio. And because the cloud application is my startup project, it's not going to just run the ASP.NET site in the little web development helper or web development server that you normally see in Visual Studio. It's going to run it in the local development version of Windows Azure. So part of the SDK is a complete simulation of all the APIs, all the storage stuff, and everything that you have up in the cloud, but running locally on my laptop. And the nice thing about running it locally on my laptop is that I get to do full debugging. So I can set breakpoints and whatever, and I'm just attached to a local process. Once you get up in the cloud, attaching to that process is sort of a nebulous kind of idea because there are a bunch of servers behind a load balancer, and it's all remote in another data center. So it's nice to have it locally because I can do all that testing. So we are still waiting for me to start up. I always do this. I forget to do it. Is that I always shut down everything, all the service and whatever before I do the talk to make sure that my machine is in a nice, clean, pristine state. And you should really start it again once because the first start is actually a little bit slow. Wow. You know what? This is the second time I've seen this error ever. And the last time was at Mix giving this talk, doing the exact same, like, hello world thing. I saw the exact same thing. I wonder if it's like somehow when I connect to, how could it possibly be related to connecting to an external video out? Let's find out what's going on. I would really like this demo to work. Busy, which means it actually hasn't. Those haven't actually started up yet. Hey, you guys get to see the CS run commands. So one of the things, everything is a teaching moment, right? So these command line tools are actually what the Visual Studio stuff is built on. So when I pressed, that makes sense because I just killed it. When I pressed F5 here, all that really did was it used a couple build tasks that call out to those command line tools. So like CS run was the one that actually runs the thing locally. I also use it to just shut the thing down to try it again. And there's also the packaging stuff and whatever, so you can actually deploy. We just did, I do this show on Channel 9 called Cloud Cover Show with a guy named Ryan Dunn. All right, my last resort is to close Visual Studio and try it again, but then we'll move on if it really doesn't work. So I do this show, Cloud Cover Show, and one of the things that we actually showed on there was recently was MS Build Tasks to actually automate the full deployment. So don't even use Visual Studio and whatever if you've got a build machine that does your builds and you want to automatically deploy it up to the cloud, you can do that too, all from the command line. So. Kind of cool, and it's also what let us build things like Eclipse tooling, because the Eclipse tooling just calls the same command line scripts, and so it works the same way as the Visual Studio tooling does, and it's kind of handy. So let's assume success, and so let's multitask here. So once I've got this thing running and I want to deploy it to the cloud, I'm going to do a little bit in Visual Studio to kind of package it up and do it, but a lot of what I'm going to do is in the Windows Azure portal, and this is where you do all the management of your apps, et cetera. So let's create a new hosted service and call it Hello Firestarter. Sure, let me... start zoom it. But here we can just probably do this and this will be okay. So when you create a service, you choose a URL, and this is not, by the way, the end of the story of URLs. You can use a custom domain if you want, but this is the one that you sort of get out of the box, is something.cloudapp.net. Hello Firestarter is available. Good. Let's pick a region. Let's just say anywhere in the U.S. and hit create. And over here, we're going to try our F5 one more time. Let me zoom back out actually for a second here. So this now says, this is basically what the world looks like now that I've basically reserved a URL and I haven't done anything else beyond that. So there's ready to be served, there's sort of load balancer and whatever, but there's nothing actually running in here. Once we're convinced that our app works here, we'll go right-click and publish, and that'll create some files, and I'll upload them in the portal. And so basically the idea is build, run, test, debug locally. Okay, so the sort of F5, you know, stop, edit, whatever, start again sort of pattern. And then package for the cloud, and then go up to the cloud portal and go copy bits there. And that's basically how stuff works. Hey, this is looking much more promising. We're not there yet, but this looks better. Now I get to put so much pressure on the tooling guys. Now that stopping and restarting Visual Studio fixed it, that means it's a tool bug, and I like that because it means it's not my problem, somebody else's. Maybe I'm speaking too soon though. All right, that was, for that little excitement of the app, that was kind of a lot of work. I'll show you a cooler demo in just a bit. So, hello Firestarter, we got that working. Let me actually just, if we step back here and go like to the code, we see the little lock there. We can actually set breakpoints and I mean, this is actually, we're in a debugging session here in Visual Studio. So just want to point out that's actually, we could do all the stuff you'd expect to do in a debugger there. Okay, so once I've got that, I'm going to right-click and say publish. And this does pretty much the same thing that we did before. So there's sort of a packaging step that puts everything together, and then you can run it locally. There's a packaging step that's slightly different because it puts it all into one file and encrypts it when we're getting ready to deploy it to the web. This will actually automatically pop up the browser and take me to the portal, but I'm already there. It also opened up this window, which has these, well, that wasn't the hotkey I was looking for, which has two files in it, and that's what gets created by the publish process, right? So I'm going to just copy that path. I'm going to go here and say deploy. I'm going to upload a file, Hello Firestarter package, and the configuration. And the configuration, by the way, is what says there are two instances running. Remember when I changed that to two? That basically said the scale. So after this is running, I can go and I can change that number to whatever I want and kind of scale it up and scale it down. And so that's all. That's kind of in that configuration bit. So this is now going to do, there's a bunch of work still to happen before this is live and on the internet. And so we've got to go find machines. We have to turn them on. We have to boot them up, potentially. Depends on whether there's sort of one already ready. We've got to copy all these bits to it. We've got to start that up. We have to wait for it to actually be ready. Configure the load balancer to handle the traffic and route it to these different servers, and then we're live on the internet. So the entire process takes, I think the median is still around like in the 5 to 10 minute range. The variance is somewhat high though, so it'll sometimes take you 5 minutes and sometimes it'll take you 15 or 20. It depends on kind of what's going on in the data center at the moment. So here we've just sort of stuck it on a few boxes. So there are two boxes that are ready to run, but I haven't clicked run yet. So once I click run, the rest of that process starts of kind of getting the application up and going. Okay, so with that, while we're waiting for that to finish, let's go back and talk a little bit about some of the concepts behind that, and then we'll go verify that app actually works in the cloud. So let me talk about roles. So remember I said bookmark this. Remember that there's this choice where I have, you know, what different things do I want to put in my cloud application. I chose to put the little ASP.NET web application there. But there are other things that I could choose in the templates. And really, I can choose among a lot of different things. And we call those things roles. So we basically have the idea of an application that's running in the cloud. And it consists of different roles. And the different roles do different things. And they can be scaled independently. And they can talk to each other. So if you were to draw the boxes and arrows diagram on a whiteboard of your application, the boxes are the roles, right? So you're probably drawing, I have a web front end, and then back here I have a media encoder, and over here is a web services tier. Those different boxes would be different roles in Windows Azure. And that means they run on a different pool of virtual machines, and you can scale them as you want. And a role kind of looks like this. There is a virtual machine. It's running Windows. It's basically running Windows Server 2008. So there's an operating system at the bottom. There is a role runtime, which lets you do things like find out who the other roles are so that you can find the IP addresses of your peers and, you know, be able to talk to them. If you are running some sort of web application and you want IIS, you'll have IIS sort of hosting your application. And then this yellow box is the only part that you're responsible for delivering. So you're responsible for the application code. We're responsible for getting IIS configured right and for providing that role runtime and for providing an up-to-date patched operating system. You get to choose which sort of patched version you want of the operating system, but we're responsible for getting it on the box and getting it started, whatever. Okay, so this is kind of, this is why you didn't see me making any virtual machine images or picking an operating system. In fact, I just went with the default, which are the latest bits, and configuring IIS or, you know, anything like that. That all sort of gets done for you on the platform. And this is a role, right? And so there are other kinds of roles that, for instance, don't serve up web pages or don't use IIS, and then they won't have that box, and that's why it's sort of optional. But they all kind of look similar. There's a little bit of application code gets deployed on top of the rest of the stack that we provide. Then you pick how many instances you want of these. And really, today, there's a one-to-one mapping between instance and virtual machine. So when I say, like, we're running two instances, that means there are two virtual machines somewhere in the cloud that are running my application. And you can pick how many of those you want, right? And you can scale that dynamically. So after it's running, you can change this at any time. You can have as many roles as you want. And any of them can talk to any of the other ones over any TCP-based protocol. Any ones that receive traffic from the internet will be behind a load balancer. So in this example, it's probably a bit small to see, but I've drawn kind of a load balancer taking HTTP traffic and sending it to one role and SMTP traffic and sending it to a different role. So if you're running an email server, you know, you might set it up this way. And so what you have to tell us is here are the different roles. Here's who talks to, well, here's who needs a port open internally, and here's who needs a port open externally with a load balancer. In addition, roles can talk over queues, which are down here in the corner. And queues are just asynchronous, you know, reliable message delivery. So this is, for example, well, we're actually going to show an example of thumbnail generation. There's an SDK sample with Windows Azure that does sort of a thumbnail generator thing. And that thumbnail generator sits in the back and watches a queue. So basically, there's a web front end. You upload something, put a message on a queue, back end pulls the message off the queue and does the work. So anytime you want to do work sort of later, although, you know, how much later is kind of up to you, but you want to make sure you don't drop any of the messages, then queues are kind of are your friend. They are backed by durable storage, so they don't actually get, they're replicated and they won't get lost. And they help you to build loosely coupled systems, which is really a best practice. Loosely coupled systems give you a few things. The idea of loosely coupled systems is you have, you know, you have two different components. They're connected with a queue or with some other method that doesn't require them to be sort of directly right now connected to each other. And the advantage of that is if one of them goes down, the other one can keep working. So if you're enqueuing things on a web page and then you're dequeuing them to create thumbnails in the back end, well, if the back end's gone, users can still upload images. The thumbnails will get created later, right? There'll just sort of be a backlog of work. If the front end is down, the thumbnails can still get generated in the back, and it's no problem. So it gives you kind of this reliability that if one part is down, the rest of the system can work. It also gives you independence of scale. So you can, for example, say, well, a bunch of people hit our website, but very few of them upload a photo. So I'm going to have 10 different instances, 10 virtual machines of my web front end, but I'm only going to have, you know, 2 instances in the back creating thumbnails, right? Or you could imagine the reverse, where, no, actually, people come to our webpage just to upload an image, and then we have a ton of thumbnails created. That takes a long time, and, you know, so we scale that out. So loosely coupled systems give you sort of better fault tolerance and better sort of more granular way to sort of scale different things independently. Okay, so that's kind of, that's applications in a nutshell. Let me show you a kind of, I hope, fun demo for you guys to play with, if you will, that I cooked up for this talk, and then we can go kind of look at a little bit of the pieces of it as we go. So this is a demo called annoysmarks.cloudapp.net. I'm me being smarks. So that URL is right there. It's annoysmarks.cloudapp.net. And if I unfreeze the screen, we should hopefully see this pop up. I hope. And let me check that the other pieces are running. Yes. There we go. Bad internet connection here, I guess. I wonder if I should switch off the wireless because I might be using the wireless instead of the wired. Okay, I just did something really dangerous, which is turn off what was possibly my internet connection during this demo. Okay, so are some of you guys on this? Are you on annoysmarks.cloudapp.net? Yes, anyone? One person. Oh, the wireless is bad. Oh, that's going to ruin this demo is going to be no fun. But presumably the people who are on the webcast are able to get to annoysmarks.cloudapp.net a lot better than the people in the room. And they can help me out here by basically clicking on these things. Although, you know, my internet connection seems really bad. And without my computer working, hey, there we go. Thank you for those of you who are doing this. I'm sorry for the people in the room who can't get to the site to play with it because it is quite fun. Wow, that's fast. So basically, this is the application. There's a website up in the cloud that lets people click on one of these things. There's using some of the connectivity stuff, which I'm going to show you later, that actually reaches straight onto my laptop and calls a service that I have running. Which then sets my background to whatever people told me to. I know it's called annoysmarks.cloudapp.net, but it should really be called entertainsmarks.cloudapp.net. Because so last night I got everything working and I tweeted the link to this, and in the first 10 minutes my background changed 150 times. It's going a lot faster now than it was then. And for half an hour, I just basically sat and, like I was watching TV, just watched these. There are only like 30 different wallpapers, so it's not, there's not a lot of variety, but there it is. I think unhooking the wireless actually helped my internet connection a lot. So that's what you guys are missing, but I plan to leave this on. I'm probably going to blog this sample, so I plan on leaving this running on my laptop for the next few days. So at any time when my laptop is plugged in and online, you guys should be able to do this later. I'm sorry. I just find this incredibly entertaining. Okay, so let me maximize this so it's not quite as distracting, although it's still pretty bad. Let me show you one more thing on here, which is the an upload interface here, so that I can upload a different picture here. And yes, I password protected it, because letting people put whatever picture they choose as your wallpaper, I'm not that brave. Okay, so I will not tell you guys what that password is. But here we go. I should be able to browse to a file on my machine, and I have a folder of wallpapers here that are the ones here. Let me upload this one. And I'm going to submit it. And hey, nothing happened because I'm doing work asynchronously. So I uploaded the file. It got stored in a blob. Well, actually, let's find out which one it was. So it got stored in a blob. A message got queued up. A worker in the back end dequeued the message, saw the blob, and generated a thumbnail of it. And hopefully by now that's happened so that when I F5 here, we see, where's that image? This is the one that I just uploaded. Let me try sending my wallpaper to that. Although, you know, I saw everything stop back here, so I wonder if, is all well? It's tough to demo cloud stuff when you have connectivity issues. There it is. Okay, briefly get to see that one. Too many people playing with it. Okay, let's see. How many times have 1,465 times since last night? My wallpaper has changed 1,465 times thanks to this somewhat annoying demo. So then I got to upload a file and then do it, and some magic happened there. So what I'd like to do is show you a little bit of what that magic is like, and so show you just a little bit of the code involved in this. And then we'll actually come back to this when we talk about storage. I'll come back to this a little bit, tell you a little bit more. And then when we talk about the service bus, I'll come back here and show you kind of the final piece there. So we should get to, eventually you'll get to see most of what's involved in making this thing work. And then I'll have a blog post that's about the rest of it. Okay, so we've got two roles. So remember, an application is composed of roles. We have two of them in this case. Actually, if we expand this, it's a little clearer. So we have two roles over here called AnnoySmarksWeb and Thumbnail Generator. And Thumbnail Generator is the guy who sits in the background and just loads an image and then creates a thumbnail out of it. AnnoySmarksWeb is an ASP.NET MVC application that shows that MVC for the purpose of displaying like one pretty much static page. So it's perhaps a silly use of it, but it shows that web page that we saw. It also has the admin interface with the file upload. Unfortunately, I can't show you the code for the upload page because the password is in that code, hard-coded. So if I open that file, I'm in trouble. So let's take a look at the web application. Actually, how am I going to do that? I do want to show you that code. I don't trust you. Let me... Okay, we're safe now. That's not the password. Okay, so I could have just scrolled down, actually. Never mind. We don't even need to see that part. This is the upload code. So maybe... I think it's a sort of logical way to think about starting to the beginning of sort of the flow of the application. I know that normally you sort of see that homepage first, but let's start by looking at the upload because that really kicks off that process of the thumbnail generation. So that's kind of instructive about how to use queues to build loosely coupled systems. So here we basically, there's an upload page that's just a simple form, and then the create method is where the magic happens. Basically, we construct an account. This is a storage account, so we'll talk about storage in a bit. But basically, all we do is we upload a file, right? So we get the file that was uploaded to the website. We make up a unique name by using a GUID, and we get a blob, which is basically a file in the cloud with that reference. We set the content type to whatever it was that came in, probably image/JPEG for all the stuff I'm doing. And then we upload it from the stream, right? So basically, this just takes uh, the And I can actually, I can zoom this a little bit, especially folks on the webcast probably have a hard time reading text. So we set the content type, then we upload this. So this, that part of the code, what I showed you so far, basically takes from a web form in an MVC app, takes a file that got uploaded, and transfers it over to blob storage in the cloud. Okay. This next line gets a queue called, I think, incoming, and adds a message with, and the contents are that GUID that we generated. So basically, we've stored something in a wallpapers container in the cloud that's the full image, and then we've enqueued a message that says just what that GUID is. So the worker role can just find that thing and generate the thumbnail. So that's all this does, okay? And then it just redirects us to get back. So let's take a look at, now let's jump over to the thumbnail generator. And thumbnail generator has a create thumbnail method, which is utterly uninteresting, but creates a little, thumbnail of the image. So it just uses some system.drawing stuff to do that. Okay. The interesting part here is here in run, where we're doing something similar. We're getting an account. By the way, this account just comes from a connection string that I've put in this application. Which I got from the web portal. So, like, I go to the web portal, I create a storage account. We'll talk a little bit about storage accounts later. A nice little API lets me just sort of connect up to it. I go to the blobs. I have two different containers, one for the full wallpapers, one for the thumbnails. I get the message off the queue. This is an interesting part about queues. How many people have, like, worked with a reliable queue system or, you know, something that does sort of guaranteed delivery? So you guys know, and the rest of you may not, that the typical pattern for these reliable queues is when you dequeue a message, it's not really gone from the queue. It's kind of invisible for a period of time. That lets you have time to operate on that message. And if for some reason you fail to finish doing what you're supposed to do with that message, after some period of time, it'll reappear on the queue so someone else will pick it up. So the way that you guarantee somebody does the work that the queue message represents is when you dequeue it, it actually sticks around, which means when you're done, you have to remember to go delete it. So you dequeue it, and then you delete it. And what this line does is this says, get a message from the queue and set that invisibility period to 1 minute. So give me a minute to work on this in case it's a really big file and the thumbnail takes a while to generate. I don't know. A minute's probably way too long. But you really have a lease on that message for a minute. And then if we zoom down quickly to the bottom here, then we delete the message only after we're done and we've saved the thumbnail. So this way, if for some reason we fail, somebody else will pick up the work and do it. Okay, so then we take the string from the message, which was that GUID, which is also the name of our blob. We get a reference to the original one. We get a reference to where we're going to put the thumbnail. We do a little manipulation here to get the stream. We set some properties on the thumbnail, like the content. My code always emits JPEGs from the thumbnail thing, so it's always image/JPEG. We set some cache control. We'll maybe talk about that later. And then we upload it to the thumbnail. So we create the thumbnail here. That gives us a stream back. We upload that stream to our thumbnail blob, and then we're done. Okay? Yeah? What is the max age that number for? The thing when I said, we'll maybe talk about that later, you're saying, no, talk about it now? Sure. Cache control is for the CDN, which we haven't talked about, so it's a little bit of a forward reference, but there's a content delivery network on top of blobs in the Windows Azure platform, and this cache control is telling the CDN to cache these things for, I think that's a year. It's something, I pulled that number from somewhere. It's about a year, I think. And so basically I'm saying just cache these thumbnails forever, because what's the point of having to go hit the actual blob storage for this every time? CDN has locations in 18 different countries around the globe, and so people will get faster response on the image. So that's why I'm setting this caching curl, just as the hint to the CDN. And basically anybody else who's caching it, that I want this to be cached for a long time. Yeah.
The number is in seconds?
I think it's seconds. Yeah, it is seconds. Yeah. Yes?
Size limit for messages?
Is there a size limit for messages? Yes, it's 64 kilobytes. I'm looking for someone to validate this in the room, but I don't know. I think it's about 64 kilobytes for a queue message. So common thing is if you have more data than that, create a blob, stick all the data you want in there, and then put a message on the queue that that goes there. What? It's 8 kilobytes? Oh, all right, it's 8 kilobytes. So put the name of a blob and sort of reference sort of a bigger thing is the common way people pass along bigger messages than that.
Steve, I have a question from our online audience here. Can the role support the FTP protocol?
Can the role support the FTP protocol? There's a blog post by Martin, I'm going to butcher his last name, so I won't. M-A-A-R-T-E-N, so that helps a little bit. But search for, like, FTP Windows Azure, and you'll find his blog post. He's got an FTP server running in Windows Azure. He had some trouble with it, specifically around FTP, sort of passive FTP involves opening sort of arbitrary ports. And so someone connects, and then you say, oh, actually, go to this port, and then they connect up there, which you can't do in Windows Azure. You have to declare upfront what ports you want open to the public internet, and the load balancer will only route traffic on those ports. So he had to do something, and I don't know exactly what he did. So it wasn't, I don't want to say, like, yeah, sure, FTP works, because there is a bit of that protocol that is a challenge. And I don't remember exactly how he solved it, but there is a blog post by Martin that goes over that.
Okay. And another question is Windows Azure Platform PCI compliant?
I don't even know. I don't know how to answer that question.
It's a come to speaker question.
Yeah, there's sort of the question in a sense sort of assumes something, which is that something like the Windows Azure Platform can be PCI compliant, while really applications plus the platform need to be PCI compliant. And so it's sort of a complicated story. I think it is possible to build PCI compliant systems using Windows Azure Platform. It's probably a better way to say it. Okay. So, let's see if people have gotten sick of changing my desktop yet. It looks pretty static. Last change was more than 20 seconds ago. Okay. there you go. I knew that as soon as I said that somebody was going to... Okay, switching away before I get distracted again. So what have we seen? So we've seen, you know, a simple Windows Azure application. We've seen how to upload it. Yeah, I'll go ahead. Yeah, great question, which is can you communicate from a Windows Azure application to some external source? And yes. So the restrictions on traffic are inbound traffic has to go through a load balancer, and it has to be on a port that you've declared, and it has to be TCP traffic. We don't route things that aren't TCP, so you can't do UDP packets or things like that. Internal traffic within your application, you just have to say what port you want, and then you can just use arbitrary TCP. And communication outbound, any role can talk outbound to any endpoint as long as it's TCP traffic, again. So you can definitely connect up to something that's a web service that's somewhere else or something like that. Okay, so we've seen a Windows Azure application. We saw a really trivial one, which I managed to break Visual Studio with. And then we've seen a slightly more complex one that has two different roles. It's got, you know, a website, and it has this thumbnail generator, and it's actually doing something that's sort of interesting. And that's sort of Windows Azure, you know, application hosting. So that's how you run stuff in the cloud. The next thing I want to talk about is data, and I sort of touched on a couple things on data, but there are different options for data in the Windows Azure platform, and I want to make sure we cover all of them. There is going to be a talk on storage by Brad Calder, I think, next, and then there's going to be talk about SQL Azure in the afternoon. So you're going to see some of these pieces in more detail. But let's talk about what the different options are. I think the simplest one is, the conceptually simplest one is SQL Azure, because it's a relational database as a service. And so if you are used to using SQL Server today, probably not a big deal to move to SQL Azure. You know, a connection string will change. There are few gotchas. It's not It's not exactly the same as your SQL Server running locally because it's a shared environment and things. But it's basically like having that relational database, except it's managed for you. So you don't have to set it up. You don't have to configure it. You don't have to configure replication and whatever. It's automated. That data is kept. Multiple copies of that data are always kept. We handle the failover if something goes wrong on one of the boxes. I mean, it's just sort of setting up a reliable cluster of database machines, but all automatically. So you go to a website and click, I want a database. The rest happens here. So it's fantastic. I mean, it's what you want in a lot of cases. Yeah, question. Okay, so what's the limit on scale for SQL Azure or are you talking?
For computing as well as storage.
Okay, so for compute, the limits are actually, there is a limit until you do a credit check of like 20 virtual machines or something, because what is 20 virtual machines 24/7 for a month is sort of gets to the point where giving you more without knowing that you can actually pay us, we get slightly uncomfortable. So beyond 20 virtual machines, you got to call us up and do a credit check. And then our limits are really about the size of data centers and whatever. I mean, so we have folks running thousands and thousands of instances. If you need sort of big, if you need 5 digits of instances, you should probably call us and check which data center you should deploy to and whatever. You know, we should probably do a little bit of thinking about capacity planning and things. But for the most part, once we've cleared your credit check, you can go put in the number of instances you want. So that's compute. You can sort of run on just about as many virtual machines as you want. Probably for almost all applications, more virtual machines than you'd ever really need to be able to use. Storage, it varies from component to component. So SQL Azure has a limitation of each database can be, so let's talk about first the scale up, which is, you know, what can each database do? There's a 1 gigabyte size, there's a 10 gigabyte size, and 50 gigabytes was just announced at Mix. So a 50 gigabyte option. And then you can get as many databases as you want. And I don't know if there's any limitation on how many of those databases you can get, but again, it's probably a really large number. And each of these, let's see, a 10 gigabyte database costs about $100 a month in SQL Azure. So massive, massive scale, like I'm going to have thousands of these things or whatever, it's more likely you're going to use one of the other options, so we'll get to those. So I think for all practical purposes, it's the same as compute. As many databases you would like to have, we'd be happy to sell you, I think is the idea. So that's really it for scale out. And that is the model for SQL Azure. You know, each database can be, you know, 110 or you know, now coming 50 gigabytes, and then you scale out by just adding a bunch of databases. But it's up to you to figure out how to do the scale out and how to do it. This is basically sharding, right? If you need to shard your database, you have to think about how you're going to do that, how you're going to route the queries to the right database server, et cetera. And so those are things that you have to figure out with SQL Azure, but you can do it. So it can achieve the scale that you want. And the beauty of it is really it's a relational database. You don't have to learn something new. I'm looking at the time. I'm probably going to skip it. I could go to a web page and click, I would like a new database, and then click, give me the connection string. You already know that's the story, right? You go to a web page, you click a button, it says, okay, what size database would you want? And then you say, okay, give me the connection string. You paste that into your web config or whatever it is you're doing, and then you use it like a relational database. So there's really nothing to kind of using this. Windows Azure Storage is the storage that's built into the Windows Azure component. So the stuff that I used in this demo with where the wallpapers and thumbnails were stored, that's actually in Windows Azure Storage. Windows Azure Storage is about huge, huge scale. So remember I said, you know, a 10 gigabyte database in SQL Azure costs about $100 a month. In Windows Azure Storage, it's 15 cents per gigabyte per month. Is sort of the storage cost or whatever. And that's what it's designed for. It's built at sort of a massive scale distributed file system, really. It's sort of custom grown from Microsoft. It runs on Windows Azure. That's why it's sort of Windows Azure Storage. It actually just runs. It's managed just just like my app is running in that data center, there's an instance of the storage service also running on a lot more nodes and a lot more complex than the service I built, but it runs on the same sort of stuff. So it gets the same reliability, same ability to scale out. It's for terabytes of data, billions of rows of entities, whatever. It's really think massive, massive scale. Also think fairly primitive. So as we talk about the different abstractions, I'll go in a little more detail. But this is not a rich querying, you know, do some joins and reporting and whatever sort of thing. This is about, I've got a big file. Can I stick it somewhere and serve it out to the web? And there are four abstractions, really, blobs, tables, drives, and queues. Blobs are just big files. They don't have to be big, but they could be. Up to 200 gigabytes, because we had to pick a limit for sort of what the file size is, just so that we could performance tune for some target. There's no reason that limit can't go higher. And, of course, your total use can be, you can use terabytes of data. There's optionally a CDN, which is actually, I'll show you that in a minute, but we're using the CDN in the example that I showed you, the wallpaper thing. Tables are not tables. I said the word tables, forget it. This is an entity store, I think is the most accurate way to describe it. We call it tables, that's the brand sort of name of it. It's Windows Azure Table Storage. But this is not a relational database. This is not, there's no join, there's no group by, there's actually no sort. I mean, this is literally store something by some keys, massive scale out, partitioned automatically. You just have to pick a key, but we'll partition it. We'll distribute load as different partitions get hot and whatever. I mean, this is about what throughput can we possibly get on structured data. So this is, you know, an entity with properties. Oh, I forgot to update the slide. It's WCF data services now, not ADO.NET data services. Did you guys know that? Used to be Astoria. Everyone still calls it Astoria. The protocol is actually OData, and so it's probably more correct here to put OData on this slide because the way that you interact with the table system is a REST API. Everything's REST in this storage system here. SQL Azure does the SQL tabular data stream thing, so just like a SQL server, although they can also expose OData feeds. But everything in here, the blobs, tables, queues, drives, it's all REST API. In the case of tables, it's OData is the way that you do the REST call. So that's the format. So it's just, it's XML, Atom Pub, you know, it's not scary stuff. So I just want to, tables about, you know, storing your structured data, but, and it's very simple kind of storage, retrieval, minimal kind of query capabilities. You can do sort of scans for, you can do matching queries like, you know, give me one where this column equals that, but there's only one index and that's the key. So, okay, just want to make it clear kind of that difference. Now, it's much cheaper than any other storage option you're going to find, and it scales really, really well and automatically. So it's not up to you to figure out which server is going to have which bits on it and whatever. We actually do a lot of that automatically, and as servers get hot, partitions get hot, we sort of spread other stuff off of that box so it can serve up that partition well, and we do that sort of stuff. We also do replication, so everything, there are three copies of everything in Windows Azure Storage. Yeah. Oh, what's the write consistency? It's there's immediate strong consistency. So when you write a value and then read a value, you will always get the new one. So it's not eventual consistency, which is sort of the other option here, where you know the primary has the new thing, but some of the replicas don't for a while or whatever. That's not the case here. You'll always get back the new value. Concurrency is basically, and there's optimistic concurrency on top of this. So through the REST protocol, doing things like you can do an update that says if match, whatever. So you can use e-tags to make sure that you're not clobbering some other value. So optimistic concurrency and strong consistency.
Steve, there's an online question here, sure. Which is how reliable are the debugging queuing messages? Could I lose messages?
How reliable are the queue messages and could I lose messages? You can't lose messages. The problem with queues is really sometimes getting a message more than once, really. It's designed so that losing messages would mean we had somehow our storage system lost data, which is the primary thing it's designed not to do. So they're always replicas. Queues are just one of the storage abstractions in Windows Azure. So they're stored in the same way as all these other things, which means there are always three replicas of it. So there's high reliability. We actually make a shadow copy somewhere else. So losing the data isn't really the thing I'd be worried about, or losing a queue message, as long as you don't delete it until you're really done with it. So as long as you're using it correctly, you dequeue at the top, you delete only when you're really done with it. The risk is actually getting a message more than once because, like, you timed out, you know, you said, for example, I said, well, give me a minute to create the thumbnail, and for some reason it took me a minute and 30 seconds. That means somebody else is probably going to get the message also and may try to create the same thumbnail. So it's really the thing you have to think about is making sure that your operations are idempotent, that you can do it more than once and nothing goes haywire when that happens. But you shouldn't lose queue messages. No. And let me, he had his hand up first, yeah. Is it possible to access blob storage via WebDAV? No, not directly. It doesn't expose WebDAV, but I have seen more than one person playing around with a Windows Azure service that does expose WebDAV and just acts as a front end to blob storage. So it's possible to sort of stand up your own front end that does WebDAV. I doubt it's even that difficult to do, but blob storage, the REST protocol, is not WebDAV, and it doesn't expose WebDAV directly. But you know, that actually brings up something which I think I forgot to say, which is that all of the storage options are accessible over the internet if you want them to be. In the case of SQL Azure, you get firewall settings, so you can decide not to expose it to the internet. In the case of Windows Azure Storage, these are REST protocols out on the internet, so I can hit them from my desktop, or I can hit them from my application in the cloud, as long as I have the password, you know, as long as I have the key and can do the authentication. So scenarios like connecting up to blobs from local are definitely allowed. I actually have something running on my box now that lets me do drag, drop, copy files around and whatever. It's not using WebDAV. It's natively using the blob API. I think you were next, yeah.
Do you guarantee work reading the same queue? Do you guarantee
No. So the question, if I have two workers reading the same queue, do we guarantee that only one of them will read the message? And we don't. The guarantee is at least one of them will. Like, that you know, the message will be there, and at least one of them will get to dequeue it and delete it. But we don't guarantee that that only one does. So the pattern I'm advising is make sure that if you do the same work twice, if two people get the same message or you get, you know, one worker gets the same message twice, that doesn't have any undesirable side effects. And that's really the message. Because you have to plan for this anyway, because, for example, I, worker A, may pull a message off the queue. I may do all of the work involved in that queue, in that message, and then queue over dead before I actually delete it. Or some network glitch happens and it takes me a few seconds longer to delete the message. And meanwhile, this other guy picks up the work. So it's possible due to lots of different scenarios that you'll end up seeing the same message twice anyway. And it doesn't happen under normal circumstances. If you dequeue, somebody else isn't going to be able to dequeue till after that invisibility period. But you should design for it might happen. Be okay with sort of, oh, well, things are going to be slow if it happens. Like, if I get these things twice, that's going to be bad for my performance or whatever, because it's not going to happen very often, right? But design so that your application still behaves correctly even when that happens. I should point out, queue messages expire eventually. So actually, back to the question that was online about what can I ever lose a queue message? You can if you don't dequeue it and a long enough period of time passes. And I think today the default is 7 days. I think if you leave a message in the queue for a week, it will eventually disappear. So you can, you know, it's not that a message got lost, but it does expire. They don't live forever. Yeah, question there.
The website of the Annoy Smart.
Yeah.
I don't think, unless I missed it, it showed us the client side. So is the client side simply polling based on public cloud storage, or is it actually...
Let me get to the connectivity section, and then I'll show you. The teaser is it's using a service bus. And so if you know what that is, then you might have an idea about how it works, but I will get to that in a moment. Okay. So, yeah, one more question, then I'll go.
Applying to all of the various flavors of storage, or is it only
table storage? Does strong consistency apply to all the flavors of storage or just table storage? It's all of them. So all the blobs, drives are actually an interesting one to say that way, but I'll explain in a moment. But yeah, but the underlying stuff is all sort of has strong consistency guarantees. Drives are blobs that happen to be VHDs. So drives are, I've got a blob stored in storage, and it's an NTFS volume that I've stored as a virtual hard drive. And then we have some cute code to just help you mount that on a virtual machine. So it's basically mountable NTFS volumes backed by blob storage. The reason I said it's sort of weird to talk about the strong consistency here is because, well, you have the semantics of NTFS on sort of, you may not actually flush everything to disk. So it is a slightly different story for drives because you're working against sort of a local driver that's then flushing things out to blob storage. And so so do think about that. But that's basically what drives are. They can either be mounted, you know, in write mode and only a single writer can work on it because otherwise you get weird NTFS stuff happening if you try to have two people access the same disk. But for read access, you can mount it on a whole bunch of different machines and do read access on it. So it's kind of handy if you have something that uses file system APIs and you don't want to go change all that code or you don't own that code. You can just create a VHD, put it in blob storage, use a drive to mount it, and you're good. Queues, we already talked about, so who cares? Dallas. Dallas is, I guess, a storage thing, although that's sort of the best place to put it, I think, is around data, but it's really about, it's an information marketplace. Is the best way to describe it. It is a place where you as a developer can go, well, I need this certain set of data. Where can I get it? Well, you can look through this catalog, find someone who has it, hopefully get it for free if they were kind enough to give it out for free, or pay for it for, you know, whatever they sell it at. So it's a marketplace. If you have data, if you run some application, you've collected an interesting set of data and you'd like to monetize it, this is a place where you can go sell that data, get it listed in this marketplace, set the price that you want. Developers will come and they'll pay to access the data. So there's all sorts of cool stuff in there already, like Associated Press articles are in there, Mars imagery, courtesy of NASA, is in there. Some is free, some is paid. Actually, at the moment, I think it's all free because they haven't done the billing stuff is still coming on Dallas. So at the moment, they're all sort of free in trial mode, so use them now. And then I think some of those are going to convert to paid things, and we'll see others come on and whatever. It's very easy to use this stuff. It's a REST API. It's OData, in fact. And so that's the way that you kind of get at all this stuff. The really cool thing is that when you go to the Dallas page, you subscribe to some data, there's a link at the bottom to download C# classes. So forget OData and having to figure out how to consume the feed. It's not that hard, and you can do it from a lot of different languages. But just click the C# classes, and then you can go, you know, newsitems.topstories or whatever. I mean, you just get an object model on top of it. So it's very cool. I have in one of the Cloud Cover show episodes on Channel 9, I did a demo of Dallas, which if you're curious about how easy it is to use, check that out. And it was, I get the Associated Press articles, download a C# class, put up a little web page that displays them in, I don't know, 10 minutes or whatever. Because I wanted to explain a lot of stuff, but it's incredibly easy to use. So that's data in a nutshell. Let's move on to connectivity because that's going to answer the question of how did my wallpaper change? And actually, it answers the question of what is this thing, which I've popped up a few times that, as you see, is logging each change to the wallpaper with the timestamp and whatever. That's running on my local machine, and what is that doing, and how does that connect it up to what's running in the cloud? So connectivity, there are two things that I want to talk about in here. They fall under the umbrella term of the Windows Azure Platform App Fabric. That's long to say, so I usually just say Service Bus and Access Control instead of Windows Azure Platform App Fabric Service Bus and Windows Azure Platform App Fabric Access Control. I had to practice a lot to be able to do that. But anyway, they're more commonly just known by Service Bus and Access Control. And they do two different things, both around connectivity. The Service Bus solves this problem, which is I've got two applications. They're both behind firewalls, and they want to talk to each other. And guess what? That's the situation with my wallpaper thing. I've got an application that's running. Actually, it happens directly through the browser here. So really the scenario there is your browser on your laptop is behind a firewall. My browser on my laptop is behind a firewall. somehow I want you to be able to send a message to my laptop that says change the wallpaper. How am I going to do that? Similar to the instant messenger problem, right? Like, if I want to IM my friend, but we're both at work and we're both behind firewalls or whatever, how does that happen? Well, the magic that occurs is we both connect up through a relay in the cloud. And that's what the service bus does, is it says, okay, both of you need to get out through your firewall, which is fairly easy to do. And in fact, you do it over port 80 or whatever, or 443 more commonly. And you make outbound connections to the service bus in the cloud. And the service bus passes the messages back and forth and keeps track of state and helps reconnect people and whatever. And if possible, negotiates sort of a direct connection and lets the two talk directly to each other, which also happens when you're using an instant messaging client. Try sending a file sometimes. Sometimes you'll see it start really slow and then all of a sudden it zips along. And that's because a direct connection happened, which is possible. So the common patterns for App Fabric are things like eventing, one-way communication, unicast or multicast. You can buffer messages if you want. So there's a sample there's a sample with the Service Bus SDK, with the Windows Azure Platform App Fabric SDK, that shows how to do a trace listener that like sends events through the service bus, which means you can sort of push events from any box anywhere to your laptop in sort of real time by sort of using a connection through the service bus. It's kind of cool. Remoting, you know, remote procedure calls, request response or duplex, you can push anything really. I mean, the bottom line is it's a pretty flexible thing. There's some cool demos actually. Clemens Vasters is the guy to follow if you're into this stuff. His blog is blogs.msdn.com/ClemensV, ClemensV. He's the man when it comes to the service bus stuff. He did a demo, which was really cool a while ago, that actually sort of inspired me to put this thing together, where he ran a blog on his laptop. So he spun up, you know, local IIS or whatever, ran a blog, and then used the service bus to expose that to the internet so that anyone who went to that HTTP endpoint got that port forwarded basically to back to localhost on his box, and he served the stuff back out. So he basically ran a web server from his machine through the service bus endpoint in the cloud. So kind of cool, and actually very similar to what I'm doing here. So you can find a whole bunch more examples of stuff that happens there. So that's a service bus. Let's actually, let's see how that's working for us in this demo. I have that code here. So this code, I guess the thing to say about the programming model for service bus is it's basically WCF, and then you like switch a couple bindings. Like that's kind of what it is. And in fact, there's a walkthrough, I think, in the Windows Azure Platform Training Kit of like Hello Service Bus or whatever, that I think starts with a WCF service that already exists and just works by listening to port whatever or something, and then just changing the binding. So like a configuration only change pretty much. There's two lines of code, I think, to discover the endpoint, which I'll show you. But basically that's it. It's sort of like a configuration setting. So to my laptop, you know, the way that I write this code is like I'm just exposing a WCF service. But I want to expose it to the whole web, and I need to punch through a firewall to do that, and so I'm using the service bus as the actual endpoint. But my code that handles this code is sort of expecting a request and replying with some data, right? So there's an interface with one method called setWallpaper that takes a GUID that comes from the cloud. We use some API to set the wallpaper. That's basically all this does. And then we return a stream which says that little message that if you guys have clicked on this, you've seen you've changed my wallpaper to whatever. That was really annoying. Please don't do it again. That message, which only seems to antagonize everyone, gets sent back from this. So this is just a WCF service. And this whole page of code is just a WCF service. There's nothing really particularly interesting about it. Here's a little bit of an interesting part, which is I'm using this servicebus.createservice.uri to figure out what thing I'm supposed to listen on. And then I start listening at it, right? this just creates a new host, says open, and at the bottom, if I press a key, says close. So that's it. So there's like nothing to, just like a lot of the stuff in here should look really familiar. I'll open up the app config in a second, and we'll see how some things are different there. But yeah, question.
Yes. Can you still add your own behaviors?
Yes. Yeah. It's WCF. I don't know what all the limitations are. There's a binding limitation, which is that there are only a couple. Let's open app config. There are a couple characters missing from that issuer secret, so you guys can't hack me totally. So, for example, in the binding, I'm using web HTTP relay binding. That's like web HTTP, but with the word relay in it, and relay is just the service bus thing. So there are only a few of those, so it's not sort of free-for-all, let me put something out there. Although, if you go read Clemens' blog, he's doing a lot of interesting things, and some of our partners are doing interesting things around just simple, like I just want to forward TCP packets back and forth, which can then open up to doing a lot of other things. But so there's a few constraints around sort of the relay binding that you use. What else did I have to do here? I had to set this shared secret. So this behavior basically puts in my credentials that I got from the service bus portal. And the service bus portal, when I created my endpoint, which is annoysmarks dot whatever it is, servicebus.something.net, they gave me a name and a secret. That's what goes in here. That's about it. I turned off some debugging stuff, and this should look fairly familiar to anybody who's doing WCF stuff. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a great question. So from the client perspective, is it push or pull? It's a bit of both. So from both sides, to make the connection, both sides establish a connection with the service bus, which means they do a request, which means it looks sort of like pull on both sides. From that perspective, from sort of the protocol perspective there. From the programming model, it looks like push. Because what happens is you establish this connection, and it's like long polling. It's the connection's open, and finally something gets sent down because it came through the pipe. And so you treat it, when you're programming your WCF, like you saw me opening the connection, and like I'm listening, right? So you treat it that way, and that's sort of the glory of the program model service bus, is you get to treat it like it's a push model, and that's how this code works, is it just sits there and listens, and when a request comes in, it changes my wallpaper. It's not on a timer kind of polling every once in a while, or whatever, which is another way you could build this, but not the way that it works with a service bus. So technically, at the protocol, the guy initiating the connection is always sort of the local nodes. You know, the service bus never reaches in directly that way. But once you establish the connection, it sort of does two-way stuff and makes it all look however you want it to, really. Yeah. Does that mean you have to worry about scalability of the service bus? Yes. We have to worry about the scalability of the service bus. Yeah, there is, and in fact, I'm abusing the service bus a little bit in this example, because it's not the common thing that you do. Is if you want to expose an HTTP endpoint from something in your data center, you open the firewall. Like that's a more common way to do this thing. But if what you want to do is, for example, if I didn't open up to the World Wide Web and just said, no, my service should be able to change my wallpaper, that's the more common scenario where there's like one guy there and one guy here. And so we're abusing it a little bit this way. But the service bus is designed to reach, you know, pretty good scale for most of the things that you want. The pricing model is per connection. So it's sort of the maximum number of simultaneous connections you have at any point. And each one is on the order of a few dollars, I think, or something. So it's not like you're going to run this with a million simultaneous users connected to something. Not that my laptop would handle that anyway, but you're not going to use it for that kind of scenario. The more common thing is, oh, I've got a dozen clients of this web service, or I've got some, you know, something like that. But yes, you should, you know, should think about and ask the questions about the scalability of the service bus. Okay. So that's the final piece of the puzzle. That's it. I just run this thing locally. It opens up this connection. You can actually see it if we click something here. By the way, I'm refreshing here because I gave someone the credentials to the admin page to feel free to upload funny pictures during the presentation, and I don't know if it's happened. Good internet connection. Okay, let's click one of these things just to see, because I want to show this this URL, which is annoysmarks.servicebus.windows.net. So that's the endpoint that the service bus gave me. /annoysmarks/set wallpaper. That comes from my WCF contract, set wallpaper. ID equals and then a GUID came from the parameter for the method of my WCF contract. So, I mean, this is just, if it weren't for the domain name, this is what it would look like if I were calling this WCF service locally. And so that's all that's happening. So clicking a button on this page, it's not that the Windows Azure application is setting my wallpaper. It's actually that you are through the browser. So you can actually just browse to this directly, https://annoysmarks.servicebus.windows.net, and change that, and it'll sort of pop up on my box. Connectivity is really bad here. I wonder if I click this, if we'll be able to see it. Did you see it just pop up? This new line just sort of came there. So it's pretty real time because there's a connection already open and it's sort of doing it. So you get to treat it just like this push model. It looks like my internet connection just sort of woke back up. So I'm so disappointed that there aren't funnier pictures here. Yes, David, I'm looking at you. You missed your chance to, you know, get a funny picture. Yeah, I know, you can't connect to the internet. All right, that is a fair excuse. Okay, let's go back to the slides, talk about one more piece, and then my time is up. Access control is the last piece in the connectivity sphere. Access control is about claims-based authentication on top of REST APIs. That's sort of that's probably the most specific way to talk about the scope of access control as it stands today. And access control is going to do some more things, and actually it already does. Like it does Active Directory Federation and some things like that. But the idea is, there are really two core scenarios, I think. I've got a REST API, I want to give some people access, I'm going to do some claims-based authentication, because that's what everybody, the cool kids are doing these days. But I don't want to write all that logic to handle the claims and to map request claims and output claims and whatever. I don't want to handle all that. Access control is a service that I can just use that lets me sort of set up those claims, set up the mappings, handles it all for me. We use a standard called OAuth Wrap, which is sort of similar to OAuth itself, and something called Simple Web Tokens, which are sort of a fancy way to pass a key or a claim through REST APIs. And so you can do this on any platform. The access control service itself is a REST-based API. It does this claims-based authentication. You get all that stuff rolled into one with one code base, including the Active Directory Federation. So if you've got enterprise customer, you know, who has Active Directory, they want something in cloud, they want single sign-on, and it should just sort of work, they can use access control to help do that. This is what it looks like. There's a REST service. It exchanges a secret key every once in a while with access control so that they maintain sort of a trust relationship. The client says, oh, I want to access this REST service. It talks to to access control, sends a request access token, which can be plain text, signed, or it can be from Active Directory. The access control service then returns a simple web token, which is sort of the access token. So you send a request token, you receive an access token, and then you connect straight to that REST service with that token. So if anybody's done, if you've done OpenID or you've done Facebook Connect, even is a sort of similar protocol. Twitter, sign in with Twitter. Like these are actually all doing very similar things, where there's sort of a negotiation over sort of tokens, and then you have the final token that lets you access the service directly. So that's access control. Yeah, question back there.
Does the access control mechanism integrate with SQL Azure as well?
Does access control integrate with SQL Azure as well? I think the answer is no. It's certainly not for the tabular data stream version of SQL Azure, which is a binary protocol and whatever. But they have just announced in their sort of labs environment the OData support, where they expose an OData thing. And I'm actually not sure what the access story is for that, and whether even if it's not baked in, I bet you could use access control to sort of grant access and permissions to different people to the OData version of it, because that's a REST protocol and can use simple web token and things like that. So not 100% sure of that, but that would be the place to look, is on the lab stuff and expose an OData stream and see it. Dallas, if you sign up to be a provider of data on Dallas, you can use access control as a way to kind of handle the access to that. Yeah, question here.
If you have an existing secure token service, come back and together to this website.
Sorry, say it again. If you're on the existing
service in your running in your local network, can we get back to this?
Oh, okay. So if you have your own service and you just want it, like not a cloud application, but just an application you've got running on premises, can you use access control? Yes. It's a REST API that's public. All these different pieces are completely independent, and you can pick and choose which ones you want. So you can use access control. You have to put some logic in the REST service that knows how to validate a token. The client has to be able to do this sort of exchange, but that's it. You can use this from anywhere with anything. I'm going to have to stop taking questions in a second because I'm going to be out of time, but let me do the two of you and then I'll stop. Yes, you first. Yes. The question was, is there a separate pricing model for access control if that's all I want to use? The answer is yes. I don't actually know what the details of the access control pricing model are. They're probably, I actually don't know what it's based on. But if you go to windowsazure.com, click pricing or whatever, which of course you can't do now because apparently we have a bad internet connection, but the details are there. So yes, you can consume it separately. Yep.
So instead of ACLs on storage?
You can use access control to set up ACLs on storage. There's nothing built in to support doing that, so I guess the answer would be no. You can always put on top of... There are lots of ways that you can put a service on top of storage that helps you to do authentication, either by passing the data through it, or by... We have something called shared access signatures, which let you basically give a pre-authorized URL. And so then you can use the access control to sort of... authorize people to give them that URL, which then they can use to directly access it. So you can do something like this, but there's nothing out of the box. There's nothing baked in that's going to do this. What's that?
There are ACLs on storage.
Actually, I just saw Brad enter the room. He's giving the talk next about storage. He'll probably talk about those. You could ask him again if he doesn't cover something that you want. But there is a system for that. It involves sort of setting up, you know, a named ACL for each user and then giving them those credentials, and then you can revoke them later or whatever. So you can do that sort of thing. Okay, so that was the Windows Azure platform in a nutshell. This is the application that I'm running on my machine. It's got a web role, a worker role, queue in between. Web role writes a wallpaper to blob storage and queues a message. Worker dequeues the message, reads the blob, converts it to a thumbnail, saves that thumbnail. Your browser goes to the load balancer to the web page to see that list of thumbnails. It goes through, actually, I haven't drawn in the CDN, but it actually goes through the CDN to blob storage if it's not cached already, to get those thumbnails and actually view the images in the browser. Then through the magic of Service Bus, your laptop and my laptop, which are both behind firewalls, talk seemingly directly to each other through this Service Bus endpoint so that you can tell my laptop to change the wallpaper. And that's kind of how it works. So with that, I'm out of time. And I think, do we send them to a break now?
So right after your talk.
So 15-minute break, and then I'll hang out here during the 15 minutes. So if you guys want to ask me some questions, something, feel free to. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. Yeah, so a quick announcement. If you're going outside, if you want to catch some fresh air, be sure to have a visitor badge. You'll need that to come back. Otherwise, the restrooms are right around the corner, and catering has been moved here to the room behind you. Thanks.